Alrighty, hello again, everyone, and welcome to it. It is the 21st day of March, 2024. It is Thursday. Yeah, think about that for a second. Yes, I did. I'm not ashamed to admit it. A little embarrassed, but not ashamed. I'm Derek Hunter. It's the Derek Hunter Podcast. Welcome to it. Don't forget to support the program. Patreon.com/Derek Hunter Podcast or DerekHunter.locals.com. Splendid time guaranteed for all for the low, low price of $5. $5 a month. What do you waste $5 on? You get entertainment here, and you're wasting $5 on gum these days, considering how everything's are. This hasn't even increased with inflation, for God's sakes. We're saving you money by you helping out the show. Think about that. Don't think about it too hard, because it probably won't make sense if you really try to scrutinize it. But otherwise, just give it a shot. Patreon.com/DerekHunterPodcast or DerekHunter.locals.com. Much, much appreciated. Love everybody over there. All right. Enter the contest, too. Signed Donald Trump Jr. book. Up for grabs. Going to be given away next week. All right. Thanks. Let's start the show. Okay. We've got a lot going on. A bunch of things to talk about. Christine Blasey Ford. Oh, my God. Are you making fun of a sexual assault survivor? No, of course I'm not. I don't believe for a second she's a sexual assault survivor. So I'm not making fun of a sexual assault survivor. I'm making fun of a liberal tool. She's got a book out, and they tried desperately to resuscitate her. They tried desperately to resuscitate her in the eyes of the Views audience. Having gone through it, books, when a book comes out, you've got it a week. Your first week is when it's a hit. Occasionally, there's something where somebody down the line mentions your book, and they're like, oh, my God, it blows up and whatever. But your publisher really cares about the first week that the book is out. They schedule you media hits, which isn't a whole lot. If you're ever going to get a big media hit, you're going to have to kind of get it on your own, unless it's like an anti-Trump book. Then you'll be booked on The View, CNN, Rachel Maddow, whatever. But if you're a conservative, you've got the first week, and you're mostly on the phone with talk radio or podcasts. I was lucky that I knew Tucker, and so I was able to get on Tucker's show. I'll never forget, as a personal point of personal privilege. I'm sitting there in my Manhattan hotel room, right in Midtown. And I go and do Tucker at like 8 o'clock. So I'm back at the hotel around 9 o'clock. And if you're an author, if you have a book, if you put out a coloring book, whatever it is, you learn very quickly that there's no information. You just can't get information from anybody until the next day or the next week or whatever. You can get daily sales, but not until the next day. But you can watch your Amazon ranking. You watch your Amazon ranking, and it's like, oh, this is real-time feedback. So I was like, I don't know, I was in the top 100 or something like that. No, maybe it was like 400 or whatever on Amazon, which ain't bad for 200 million books out there. And I go back, and Tucker's air, it was live, and I refresh. I think it's either 15 after or 45 after every hour when they update their rankings, one of the two. And they reload it, and I'm up like I actually went higher by like 4 book points. I'm like, what the hell? I screwed it up. It's over. I really dropped the ball. My biggest media hit, and I screwed it up. And I thought I had a pretty good appearance. I had a pretty good anecdote ready to go right from the book, research, original research, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm bummed, and I start, I'm walking the streets of Manhattan, and this is kind of a waste. I go home now. It's all over. Then I get an email about an hour and a half later from the editor. He goes, hey, man, I didn't watch the appearance, wasn't able to, but I heard it went well, blah, blah, blah. Probably should have mentioned this earlier, but there's a 6-hour lag in Amazon numbers. So, like, all the book sales that you register at one point, 6 hours later, they register in the Amazon ring. They're 6 hours behind. It's like a different time zone. And I'm like, oh my God, that would have been nice to know. That would have been really nice to know as I'm sitting here contemplating throwing myself into traffic. I mean, it was a traffic jam, so it wasn't going to do any damage, but you get the point. And so at like 2 o'clock in the morning, I'm still up, and I refresh, and I went up to number 16. And I'm like, okay, thank God. Like, I didn't screw it up. But it's that first week where you're just sitting there going, what happened? What do I do? What's happening? For conservatives, for liberals, the red carpet is rolled out for them. The red carpet is rolled out for them. To get on Fox as an author now, you pretty much have to be an employee of Fox, right? And in your contract, I believe, I've been told anyway, that Fox gets their bequit from your book sales. And you sit there, well, what? That's not fair. How is it? Well, it's because they're going to promote the hell out of it. If you're going to use their airwaves, they want their bequit. It's a business. You sit there and you think, well, we're all conservatives, we're all Republicans, we're all... They're not. Fox is a business. It is run by leftists. Rupert Murdoch is not a leftist. His son is not a leftist. But they're businessmen first. The people they hire when you're fishing in Manhattan for people to come and run your company, you're going to find 95% liberals. So it's liberals. They might not be doctrinaire, left-wing, lunatic, chain yourself to the Van Gogh exhibit liberals, but they're liberals nonetheless. They're certainly not conservatives. So they just don't. There was one prominent host on Fox. I went to my hotel when I was up there was two blocks from where the Rush Limbaugh studios were. Now, Rush didn't do his show from New York. I hadn't done his show from New York in 20 years or whatever. Didn't want to pay the taxes, didn't want to deal with the hassle. He was always in Florida, but my friends who worked there were still working there. So I get to go and walk around the premiere in the iHeart studios and the world headquarters. You can see why they went broke. They spent a lot of money on this, like $2,500 chairs in a conference room with 150 seats. Like, wow, you really? All right, there you go. Holographic projector on steam. In the hallway, in case U2 shows up, you can have Bono walk alongside Bono in holographic form. You're like, huh, I can see why they maybe went bankrupt. But I was talking to somebody else who was a producer of a large nationally syndicated show, not going to name names. And I said, hey, and I talked to this person before. I'd been a guest on the show once or twice, usually with a guest host, but not always. And I said, hey, you know, my book is, oh, yeah, I know. Is there any way we can get in? Well, we only do books for friends of the show. And it's like, well, you can't become a friend of the show unless you're an employee of the network. Like, that's the only way to do it. Like, okay. So if you're conservative, you're hamstrung by the incest is best rule. And if you're a liberal, The View rolls out the red carpet. It doesn't move books, though. It's weird. My publisher the other day, or my editor, I guess he's now like the vice president of the company at HarperCollins, but he, you're saying how they'd rather have, because somebody's like, oh, you can get on this show, this streaming show, and like, I'd rather have one hit on Fox and Friends than a full hour on whatever this streaming show is. It just, there are certain things that move books. They do this for a living, so they know. The View is one of those things that moves books, if you do it right. Christine Blasey Ford must not have done it right, because her book just this morning cracked the top 100 on Amazon. The top 2,000 of the books that are selling on Amazon, the top 100 are the books that are really moving on Amazon. Just how it is. Like, well, I'm ranked number 30,000. Okay, that means you sold a copy of your book today. That's all it means. You're not moving hundreds of copies. You sit there and you've listened to the numbers of the publishing industry and you go, it seems like they're small, right? You sell 3,000 books in a week and you run risk of being a New York Times bestseller at the top of the list. And you're like, that seems a little, it depends on the week. That seems low. But the industry has figured out how to monetize it. Used to be a lot more than that back when people read. Now they don't read, but it used to be a lot more than that. So Christine Blasey Ford, you're selling hundreds of books a day if you're in the Amazon top 100. Again, shocking, I know. Now, you could be selling millions of copies of books a day and you'll be in the Amazon top 100 too, but just as a general rule of thumb, that's how it works out. And she had, I think, the full hours. The only way I can figure out is she sat there and listened to these people on The View kiss her ass, and she managed to turn people off. She sold some copies. There's no question about that, but there's no way she sold enough to make anywhere near her advance. She got paid probably six, maybe even a seven-figure advance. The left uses the publishing industry to launder money to supporters. They can't flat out pay somebody to go before Congress and make up stories about high school and then can't remember any of the details. But you can do it by proxy. You can do it on the side. I'm surprised she actually waited this long to put out a book. But when you can't remember any of the details from it, from the event you're supposed to write about, I suppose that makes it a little difficult to write the books. Remember when Christine Blasey Ford accused Brett Kavanaugh of sexual assault, she didn't remember the year. She didn't remember the location. She didn't remember anything. But she did remember her friend was with her, who told investigators she wasn't there. She doesn't know what the hell she's talking about. There was no such party. And she didn't believe that what her friend was saying was actually true. Like, oh, that's it's pretty interesting. You'd think that didn't get much attention, the fact that nobody came forward and backed up Christine Blasey Ford's story. Not a single human being. And her friend Leland Kaiser said no. She said she, quote, she didn't have any confidence in her friend's story. And she also said, Leland Kaiser, that friends of Blasey Ford and liberal activists reached out to her and pressured her to tell a different story. You remember this. You remember she was wildly upset. And what makes Leland Kaiser, before we even get to the Blasey Ford clips, what makes Leland Kaiser's testimony so important, and it is important and telling, is that if she went to a party, a very small party with like eight people, with her friend, if she went to her party with a friend and they're in high school, 16, 17 years old, when you're dependent on somebody for, you know, one of you is driving, the other one's riding, whatever. If the person you went with disappears, just disappears, you remember that. You bring it up with them the next time you see them. You know, Saturday night at the party, and then it's time for you to go, and either you drove, and you're like, where's Christine? I got to drive her home. Or Christine drove. Where's my ride? And she's gone, and you got to make other arrangements or hoof it. Come Monday, if not Sunday night, Sunday morning, you're going to go up to your person and say, what the hell happened to you, man? Where are you? You left me. I'm there all, I'm looking for you. I don't know what happened to you. We searched the whole house. You're gone. You couldn't have said anything to me? That would leave an impression. But also, one would assume that either your friend would go, you'll never know what happened to me. I can't talk about it. Or they'd be really weird, which would also leave an impression. The fact that none of that appears to have happened in this case, and Blasey Ford, they always say the traumatic things in life, they leave an imprint on your brain. They burn. Somehow with Blasey, and I know I'm saying it wrong. I'm saying it wrong on purpose. That Blasey Ford had the exact opposite. Things did not burn. They burned off her brain. All of the details were gone except for a guy's who she's met once, allegedly, although no human being can vouch for the fact that they've even ever been in the same room, and what he did to her while his friend left. She thought he was going to kill her. And apparently it impacted her to the point that she perpetually sounds like a 12-year-old with social anxiety disorder, because that's what she sounds like. So let's get to the audio of this fraud, because she is going to be, for 1 week, the media is going to focus on propping her up over propping up Joe Biden. They're going to try to do both, but she's going to be the priority. So the ladies in The View were very upset that there are people out there who still don't believe a story the person who told it admits she has no real recollection, she has no memory, she has no, can't remember the details, can't remember when, can't remember the year, can't remember the location, can't remember anything about it, except for she's certain that a guy she at most met once in her life is the guy who allegedly tried to feel her up or something. And The View is very mad that people don't believe that.
Yeah. Well, you've been called a highly credible witness, and you have a PhD in psychology. You're a professor. You teach at Palo Alto and Stanford universities. But even today, some people remain skeptical of your story. And you write that during the hearing, Senator Lindsey Graham wouldn't even make eye contact with you. Were you prepared for that kind of response?
I was prepared ahead of time that that none of the Republicans were going to speak with me, and they were going to use an outside interviewer.
God, I'd forgotten how annoying her voice was. I was prepared for, you know, going to the mall and hanging out and doing it. Oh, my God, you're making fun of a sexual assault survivor. No, I'm not. I'm making fun of Christine Blasey Ford. Let me tell you another little pro tip here. If you're using credentials to boost your credibility on something unrelated to your field where those credentials are, what those credentials are in, you're doing it for a very specific reason. It's because it's the only way you can get credibility is distraction, is the sleight of hand game. You have a PhD, you teach at two universities. What does that have to do with what she alleges in high school? That does her academic record in no way, shape, or form changes the reality that she can't tell you what year this allegedly happened. She can't tell you anything. He is and was a nerd. He kept meticulous records of his goings-on. He kept a journal of his schedule, of his day. I don't do that to this day. It drives my wife nuts. Why don't you send me a calendar alert? Because I just remember that I have to do something. And she's sending me all sorts of alerts for things. And I'm like, okay, you're getting your teeth cleaned. That's fine. Good. But do I need 15 emails about it? I know, she's listening. Sorry, but making a point. He kept meticulous records. We went through them. There's no party there. There's nothing. There's nothing that could have fit this in that time period. Did somebody grope her, grab her, try to make out with her, whatever? Maybe. I don't know. Was it Brett Kavanaugh? I have to say no, based on the lack of evidence. Based on the lack that anybody remembers this event. If you leave it, look, it's called an Irish goodbye, where you just disappear. You're at a party, and you just disappear. I was kind of known for them back in the day, back in Michigan. I just disappear. I'd be at a party and like, I've had enough. Or I want to go somewhere else and I'm gone. I just gone. I'm not going to hunt everybody down and go, because, you know, the parties were pretty crowded. A bunch of people I didn't know. I didn't want to find my friend. And what if my friends are in the middle of something? They don't want somebody to pop in and say, hey, I'm going to leave now. Like, okay, great. Thanks. Thanks. Unless I drove them there or whatever, I didn't need to tell them. If I met them there, that's it. So I would do that all the time. And I also like to do it for the effect, to be mysterious. It worked with some of the ladies, too. But that was the world. And I'd catch, you know, like, hey, what the hell happened to you? When did you leave last night? People knew I was there. And then they're like, where'd you go? There were no cell phones. At least there were cell phones, but we couldn't afford them. But they would say, where'd you go? What happened to you? The next time we saw him, the next day or whatever, when we were going out drinking again. But nobody, not a single human being noticed that. I mean, she sounds like Valium at a party. right? She's just, that's how she seems. The most unbelievable part of any of this is that anybody invited her to a party at all. You know, like those movies where like you invite the ugliest girl you can and whoever gets the ugliest date wins, or you get the most boring human being ever to go to the party and you win. That party I could see her getting invited to. Everything else I can't. Yet we're told she was so traumatized by this instance that she ran out of the party, left, never to go back, never to look back, and never to even remember where the hell it was. Not even a general idea of where it was. And from that moment forward, for some weird reason, she only felt comfortable in houses with two front doors. Remember that? That was one of the weirder things. I had to have a second front door put in her house, and then people looked at her house and said, that's not really what that is. And then they looked at other houses that she lived in. There's no two front doors. The whole two front door thing was just kind of a random, weird thing. A lie or a twisting of reality that you can only do if you have supreme confidence that you'll be insulated, that you'll be protected from it. And that's where our next clips come in, is she was supremely confident or ignorant or whatever about what was going on, that she'd worked for months with Democrats, and she somehow thought that there would be no cameras in the hearing. I mean, you want to talk about, you're dealing with somebody who's educated beyond their intelligence. You can have all the letters in the world after your name. If you nearly choke yourself tying your shoe, I'm not going to think you're all that bright. Right? So the ladies on The View weren't done sucking up to Christine Blasey Ford. I don't know for sure, but it seems like they gave her the whole hour. What else are the ladies at The View going to do? They're going to waste the hour anyway, so they might as well waste the hour this way. You'd be a lot of people in media. I mean, you have five people on that show. Five people on that show. And they have guests up the wazoo. And you're like, five people couldn't handle an hour? Commercial breaks, 44 minutes. You can't, five people can't handle that? Pathetic. I'm not a big fan of co-hosts, if you can't tell. But it turns out that Christine Blasey Ford's book, it sounds like a riveting read. It really sounds like, I don't know, self-dentistry or something. It's a serious amount of hatred and self-loathing that you'd have to have to sit down and read this thing. Because it's the inside story of how it's billed as a memoir. And you go, why the hell would anybody want to read a memoir of somebody you never heard of before? Like you heard of her one time, and then you're like, okay, and what was she again? She moved on. She doesn't have accomplishments. She has one thing she did. So you sit there and you go, it's got glowing reviews. Right there at the top of the Amazon page, a blistering personal memoir, a thoughtful exploration of what it feels like to become a main character in a major American reckoning. That's what the Washington Post wrote about it. But this is how the book publisher, who's trying to sell this turd, this was the best they could come up with. On September 27th, 2018, Christine Blasey Ford testified before the Senate Judiciary Committee, which was considering the nomination of Brett Kavanaugh to the United States Supreme Court. She described an alleged sexual assault by the Supreme Court nominee that took place at a high school party in the 1980s. Notice they don't say what year, because they don't know. And she's like, it's 82, 83, 84, somewhere in there. Like, oh, that's a pretty wide berth. Her words and courage on that day provided some of the most credible and unforgettable testimony our country has ever witnessed. Who wrote this? NPR? In One Way Back, Ford recounts the months she spent trying to get information into the right hands without exposing herself and her family to dangerous backlash. See, she was trying to poison Brett Kavanaugh. And the Republicans were like, no, you don't get to poison somebody. If you're going to, you got to come and stab them right in the front. That's what you do. If that's what you want, you don't get to just whisper in the back, this to me. What you have to do is tell your story publicly and back it up. And she couldn't. She couldn't. Drawing parallels to her life as a surfer, she explains the process of paddling out into unknown waters, despite the risks and fears. Yeah, she's as brave as a 10-year-old who goes out into the ocean, knowing there is only one way back to shore. The book reveals riveting new details about the lead-up to her testimony and its overwhelming aftermath, and describes how she continues to navigate her way out of the storm. This is the real story behind the headlines and soundbites, a complex page-turning memoir of a scientist, a surfer, a mother, a patriot, and an unlikely whistleblower. Ford's experience shows that when one person steps forward to speak truth to power, she adds a collective whole. She adds to a collective whole, causing a ripple that might one day become a wave. Wow. Doesn't that sound like a plot of a Lifetime movie? Aaron, it probably will be made into... No. It won't be made into a life... It'll be made into a major motion picture. It'll be probably for HBO, but it'll have its time in the theaters. They'll run it in theaters for a couple of weeks so that it can qualify for Oscar nominations. And it'll be just... It won't be a whole bunch of, you know, white ladies sitting there going, yeah, let's get them, let's get... They'll have to throw in some women and men of color and a couple of gay characters, because to qualify for the Oscars by the time this movie will be made, you have to have a diverse cast. It'll still suck, but that doesn't matter this year. So it doesn't matter any year. But doesn't that sound just terribly boring? It's a riveting story of somebody trying to secretly sabotage someone she may or may not have ever met. She can't remember any details of, but damn it, she's a committed leftist. And so she knew she had to do her duty. Yeah. She'll probably make more. She'll probably make five times the average American salary on this thing. It'll likely debut at number one on the New York Times bestseller list. I say that not because it's going to sell. Well, the Pope has a book that's outselling this. Hell, Jesse Waters' terrible book is outselling this. But it will be. It'll definitely make the New York Times bestseller list because it. You don't have to. It doesn't have anything to do with selling books. Let's just put it that way. It has to do with whatever it is that the New York Times decides is important. They won't tell anybody how they calculate their list, but in a lawsuit about 10 years ago, they admitted that it has nothing to do with sales. Okay. Abigail Schreier outsold, I think, the top four books on the New York Times bestseller list combined. Her book about the transgender garbage and all the abuse that therapy, quote unquote, is doing to kids, outsold them all combined. Didn't make the list at all, because that's how it works. That's how the left rules. But Christine Blasey Ford, and we'll know, you can check Publishers Weekly next week and you'll find out how many copies of her book she actually sold. But it turns out that it wasn't just some surfer, single mother, hero, patriot, sitting out at her kitchen table, suddenly reliving trauma that apparently has never left her. The trauma never left her, but she didn't tell anybody about it. Never explained why they had to blast a second front door onto a house, even though they didn't blast second front doors on all their houses. It kept festering in her. Yet somehow it was a 3-month collaboration with Democrats before she realized that the Democrats realized, because they tried desperately. They wanted this story out there. And even now, this is 2018, even back then, not that long ago, but there were still some journalistic standards where they're like, we can't report this. They tried, but you can't report. Hey, somebody says something happened 35 years ago. Like, okay, who says it? Can't say. What do they say happens? Not really sure. When did it happen? 35-ish years. What do you mean, ish? I don't know. But, okay, can you give me any details? No, I can't, but I can tell you that Brett Kavanaugh's a bad guy. Based on, look, I'm down. I work at the Washington Post, for God's sake. I'm down with the prospect of Brett Kavanaugh being history's greatest monster. I want to do anything. I'm willing to lie to keep him off the Supreme Court, but it's got to be kind of based in a little bit of truth. I will exaggerate whatever you... I can't tell you. And they said I can't run with it. So eventually, she realized that her attempt to poison the Kavanaugh nomination wasn't going to work. She had to go out and try to murder him. And I didn't know that it went on for 3 months. What we were told at the time, because Democrats always lie, what we were told at the time is she reached out to her member of Congress, Democrat, whatever, I can't remember who it was, out in California, and they put her in touch with Dianne Feinstein. Remember? That was it. And Dianne Feinstein's office heard her out and tried to investigate. They couldn't corroborate anything, and they just kind of said, all right, well, if you're not coming forward, we can't corroborate anything. We can't use this. And they said, but couldn't we find a way to get it into the record? And so they had an FBI investigation that found nothing. But the FBI investigation then was leaked. Because once the FBI starts investigating, then it becomes legit. Just like the Steele dossier was garbage. News reporters wouldn't, they're not going to report on the Steele dossier. It's crap. So then James Comey, one of the most corrupt, unethical individuals in the face of the earth, got together with a couple of his other friends in the intelligence community and a few friends in the media, including Jake Tapper, another unethical person, and said, hey, if we brief Donald Trump on the Steele dossier, then suddenly the Steele dossier is newsworthy. Then we can report on the Steele dossier, which we can't corroborate, but we don't have to corroborate because the story isn't that we corroborated anything in the story at that point. The story is that the president-elect was briefed on this. It was so serious and deemed so serious by the FBI that the director himself briefed the president on it. You see how that works. They created the circumstances under which they were able to claim something became news, even though the minimal standards at the time did not warrant that. It did not meet them. Same thing here. Can't prove anything. Can't do it. All right, well, the FBI investigation is enough. We're hearing stories about the FBI investigated claims that Brett Kavanaugh had sexually assaulted someone back in high school. There's your story. That's true. The FBI is investigating it. Forget the fact that the FBI was manipulated or willingly manipulated into participating in this ruse by Democrats in Congress after a three-month buildup to try and figure out a way to ruin Brett Kavanaugh. That's how this game works. And here is Christine Blasey Ford sort of admitting, look, it's admitting that there was a three-month collaboration with the Democrats and getting her story out there. What story? Honestly, if you had to tell the story of Christine Blasey Ford, what would you say? She was actually assaulted. When? Don't know. Where? Not sure. Who knew? Nobody. But it was other people? Yeah. She just stormed out screaming, crying. And nobody noticed? Apparently. How'd she get home? No idea. What did her friend think? Friend says it didn't happen. Well, all right, stop the presses.
But you also write in the book that you didn't think, you thought you could maybe just go to the FBI or go to someone. You didn't think you would ever be called in front of Congress.
Right. I never thought I'd have that day on television. I thought I would share the information with the senators and they would do with it what they felt was necessary. So I thought I was being helpful. I was trying to collaborate with them. And it was a three-month process of working up to that day on TV.
A three-month process. I was trying to collaborate with them. I was working, and we were doing it, and we just blah, blah, blah. And I was hoping that I wouldn't have to. I thought I could just destroy a guy I didn't know because I don't like his politics. And it turns out that even some of the Democrats said, "That's not good enough. We need a spectacle." Well, I knew that I couldn't provide specifics because once you put specifics on, what if, I don't know if they knew that Brett Kavanaugh kept meticulous notes of his calendar at the time. But what if she says, is the date which will live in infamy? It was July 7th, Saturday, July 7th, 1982. I remember it like it was yesterday. Like everybody who's suffered trauma remembers the day. Or at least a close approximation thereof. But if she says that, and then Brett Kavanaugh goes, wait a second, we were vacationing at the Grand Canyon as a family on that day. Then suddenly the whole thing falls apart. You can't get specific. The more wild the story, the more lie-based it is, the less specific you can be about anybody but yourself. You can be as specific as you want about yourself because it's you. But if you're going to put somebody else at a specific place at a specific time, you better pray to God they don't have a movie ticket from someplace else for that time. You better figure that out right away. If they do that, it's all over. It is all over for you. If you say so-and-so was there, and they say, I wasn't there, I don't know what the hell you're talking about. Problem. That's why I say there were friends there. There were people there. It might have been this one. It could have been that one. You don't remember anything. Well, your friend. I believe my friend was there. Your friend says she wasn't there, says she never heard anything about this. At some point, if you were sexually assaulted to the point that you thought that you were possibly going to be killed, wouldn't that alter how you act? At least for a couple of days. Wouldn't you act a little freaked out? Wouldn't then your friend, your best friend at the time in high school, notice that you're acting a little weird? Hey, you're a little jumpy when the locker shuts. You kind of jump. When you see that Kavanaugh kid coming down the hall, even though they went to different schools, you see a boy, you kind of act a little weird. What's going on? I'm concerned about you. Maybe she went to narcissist high. I don't know. Chevy Chase is a lot of money. And narcissism is high. We used to rent a house in Chevy Chase. I can vouch for the fact that narcissism is high there, but not that high. Nobody would notice this. You have to be vague, because to be specific opens up the possibility of unambiguous refutation of your allegations. And then it's all over. Then it's game over. Then you're screwed. So more from the ladies at The View. It's weird. The View has never had a trans woman host. You notice that? The View has never had a trans woman host. They haven't even auditioned one. I thought trans women were women. But weirdly, they seem to be able to tell the difference when it comes to employment. I don't know. Maybe that'll change. And I don't really know that much about Joy Behar. So maybe I'm wrong about that. It's entirely possible. I'm just holding out the possibility. I don't want to offend anybody. So if Joy Behar is secretly a trans woman, then I apologize unreservedly, and I wouldn't be surprised. It's very convincing. Good job. You fooled almost everybody. Yeah, I'm going to hell. What are you going to do? Worth it. All right, so we have next Christine Blasey Ford saying I don't know what world we think she lives in, or she wants us to think she lives in. It has to be, I mean, her testimony was that of like a scared 12-year-old. And I feel like I was scared. I didn't know. Don't be mean to me. Don't ask me tough. You're asking me tough questions. And like, all right, you're just dumb. You're just dumb. But I have letters after my name. I have vocal fry. And I always end a sentence by raising my voice. Right? All of this was true, and you sit there and you think this was the best. Who turned down the Democrats with this scam? Do you remember the other people? The one who was like, I can't even remember her name, the redheaded one, who Michael Avenatti. Remember Michael Avenatti was a part of this? It's weird how Michael Avenatti is not mentioned in any of this. Michael Avenatti brought the redheaded woman forward. Is like, oh, yeah, no, Brett Kavanaugh used to run gang rape parties. He used to run gang rape parties? Oh, yeah, I went to like five of them. You attended five gang rape parties? Like, I don't know. I could see, like, I'm not making light of it. I'm making light of these people and what the Democrats thought. And it's not even what they thought would work. It worked. The Democrats, other Democrats believe this crap. They're still out there going, I can't believe we have two rapists on the Supreme Court. And like, who are the rapists? Brett Kavanaugh and Clarence Thomas. Who accused Clarence Thomas of rape? Well, Anita Hill said he asked her out once. Yeah. She said no, and that was the end of it. She followed him from job to job after that, having seemingly no problem working with him. Still, rape. He made a joke about Coke can. Okay, what does that have to do with it? Rape. Okay, great. Christine Blasey Ford isn't even alleging rape. It's rape. All right, then you must be a huge fan of Tara Reid and what she said about Joe Biden. Look, there's no evidence of that. Well, there actually is evidence of it. Her mom called in to Larry King Live in the 90s. So clearly Tara Reid told somebody, and her mom freaking called in on national television and told the story. Well, that's different. Why? Well, because Joe Biden's a Democrat. That's why. Don't you follow the news? Oh, yeah. Good point. So the best that they come up with was this story. The best person they could come up with to tell this story was Christine Blasey Ford, who sounds like a 12-year-old, who is so clueless, so naive, if you believe her. I mean, it would take a special kind of stupid to believe this, that you think you could accuse a Supreme Court nominee of sexual assault and say you were afraid he was going to murder you. And that you wouldn't have to face any questions about that. And if you did face any questions about that, that there wouldn't be cameras there. You think that you get to dictate terms. I want to accuse somebody of something, but only under very specific circumstances. If all of my terms are not adhered to, I'll walk. Do you care more about the terms? Do you care more? You don't want to be seen spreading this crap. That's really what it is. You don't want people to see you spreading this crap. But you have to live in an alternate bizarro world to believe that you could get to the point where you're like, we're going to go to this hearing and there's not going to be any cameras because I don't want them there. You're either hopelessly naive, led an incredibly charmed life, or you're just dumb.
So that was what was most fascinating to me in the book was you said you were idealistic about the process and you thought you'd be able to stay anonymous. The story would blow over in 24 hours and that Trump may even nominate someone else to avoid the embarrassment, which he didn't. Mm-hmm. And you didn't find out until you were walking into the hearing that it would be televised. Yeah. What was that moment like for you?
Okay, well, first about the being idealistic, yes, I was definitely, people have called me naive, and I was very idealistic having grown up in Washington, D.C., and revering all of those institutions and thinking that's the place where we send the very best of people. So that idealism served me, because if I had been cynical or concerned, I don't think I would have ever made it to...
Yeah, yeah.
I would never have left the beach in Santa Cruz and gone to see my congressperson. So, but the second part of your question I haven't answered. I'm sorry, I forgot.
No, just what was the, what oh, was the I was mindset walking when down. You realized yeah. it was going to be televised?
See cameras.
So... I was very adamant that I didn't want a camera because I'm a little afraid of the camera. And they said, well, we need to have one camera so that all the senators will be able to see you. Mm. And they were telling me that when I was walking down the hallway, and it was too late to worry about it at that point. So they said it would be on C-SPAN, and I was just telling myself, okay, nobody's going to watch C-SPAN. Like, my friends are all at work. None of my friends are going to see C-SPAN at work. Fine. And then they said, well, C-SPAN, like something about people have the rights to pick up C-SPAN if they would like to. And clearly they did.
She had 3 months to prep for this. there was a, what, a week, 10-day period between the bogus FBI report coming out, that FBI had investigated this, to the hearing being scheduled. They grilled her. The reason they lied about her being afraid of flying, and that's why we can't have this testimony too quickly. She's scared to fly. She's just terrified of flying, even though she flew all over the world, flies on every family vacation. That was a lie. The reason they said that is, oh, we need more time. She's got to drive out from California. She's got to. She's too scared to fly. All that time was used to prep. She actually flew out. She's scared to fly, but she's flying into Reagan tomorrow. They used that time to prep her. They used that time to do hearing rehearsals. So Democrats would know what to say, what to do, and then they could prepare her for what it was that they thought Republicans would do. She was well-rehearsed, and you're telling me that nowhere in that process anybody said, and here's where the camera's going to be? Nobody said, you expect anybody to believe that. I didn't know until I was walking down there, but it was too late to do anything about it at that time. Yeah, you don't get to dictate the terms under which Congress operates. It's weird. You don't get to tell the Senate, here's how you're going to have to conduct this hearing. Nobody told you. Either had the greatest disservice ever done a client by an attorney that presumably, well, she probably didn't pay, some liberals, but at some point, your attorney did a major disservice to you by not telling you this stuff, or you're lying because you want to seem like more of, I was a little bit scared of the cameras. Is there anything you're not scared of? Is there anything that does not send you into a screaming frenzy like a wacky, wavy, inflatable arm guy running out of the room? Is there anything else? Do you need like a fifth door in front of it? To testify, did you need 17 extra doors cut in the hearing room there? Did you need a SWAT team on standby to come out there? Did you need any of that crap? No. Now, what's funny is she said that if Brett Kavanaugh just apologized and said, I don't know that I remember this, but I'm sorry I made you feel that way, she probably would have gone away. Yeah, right. Right. That left always, if it just confess, we wouldn't care about these things. No, you would immediately call a press conference and go out there. You can tell she's terrified of the cameras by the way she spent an hour on The View, by the way that she's giving interview after interview after interview, giving a tour of her life to every left-wing media outlet. You can tell this has been a very difficult time on her family, what with the way she got to crash at Oprah's place and hang out with Oprah, the way that Steve Jobs' widow made her breakfast one day. Yeah, this is all part of the glowing New York Times coverage of her. We learn all of these things. It was the best thing. It's when the worst thing to ever happen to you is the best thing that ever happened to you, you've led a charmed life, or you're in on it. If it was the biggest moneymaker in your life, maybe we should question the sincerity of your trauma, right? Shouldn't we? But we're not allowed to, of course. It's a monster, horrible, horrible thing. I have one more clip here of Sonny asking Christine Blasey Ford about the... Wow, you get two of the most obnoxious people on the face of the earth, you put them together, it's pretty amazing that the universe didn't collapse on itself, to be honest with you.
Oh, well, the book is fantastic, and I know that it will help people. And I, like Whoopi, I applaud you on your courage and your bravery. That was a very brave thing that you did.
Thank you.
So let's remind everyone, you've accused now Justice Brett Kavanaugh of sexually assaulting you at a high school party in the 1980s, saying you were afraid he might accidentally kill you. Now, we're not going to rehash the details, okay, because of the alleged attack. But you've largely stayed silent about it for decades. Tell us about the moment you realized, oh my goodness, he is going to be on the Supreme Court. I need to come forward with my story.
So I realized that as soon as Justice Kennedy retired, that it was a possibility, and I started to be concerned about it when I saw his name in the news on the short list, and I thought it was imperative that I share the data, and I knew it was going to be difficult, but I also realized it was going to be more difficult to not say anything, that I would just feel terrible if I didn't say anything, and that I wanted to share the information that I had about him.
Yeah, I wanted to share I didn't have any information, but I wanted to share it. The ladies on The View then lamented that people said mean things to her. Her family was threatened. Her family abandoned their home with two doors to stay in a hotel with private security paid for by rich liberals. Not once in this was it ever mentioned that the left inspired a man to travel across the country to try and kill Brett Kavanaugh and his family. Not just him, his whole family. That, like, oh, yeah, no, that doesn't matter. But Christine Blasey Ford, who offered no evidence, you know, I knew the second that you're tracking this guy, you're following this guy. No, you were very involved in left-wing politics. The second that this story started to come together, that's when, because it was weird, right? 2018, she had no social media footprint, nothing. Not only her, there was no mention of her anywhere. Before that, she's a college professor, no mention of her anywhere. It doesn't exist. There's no Facebook page, no nothing. She deleted it all, not because she was afraid that Brett Kavanaugh would hunt her down one day and try to finish the job, but because she did not want her left-wing activism to be known. It's easier just to delete the whole damn thing than if you go through and try to delete post by post and clean it up before you come out. That'll A, take forever, and B, you could miss something. And see, maybe somebody notices that things are being deleted and does a couple of screen captures going, what's going on there? Can't have that. Delete the whole thing. And also, it takes a little bit of time. You delete your accounts on a lot of these websites, you still have a couple of weeks to a month to undelete your account. In that time, certain things will show up in search results. Certain thing, it'll show this account is no longer active. This account is whatever. Like, oh, but that account existed and still technically exists. It's just not active right now. It's in the process of being deleted. If you are known at that time, you need enough time to be able to delete your accounts so that they don't show up in search results. So it doesn't show that you're deleting your account, so that they're actually gone. That's what you have to do. Now, it sucks. You got to maybe save all those photographs that you uploaded to Facebook, but it's a small price to pay for your progressive politics and political stardom, isn't it? But she's the real victim here, isn't she? What a complete and total load. Yeah. This is how left-wing politics works. I mean, look at Stacey Abrams lost two elections. Lost the first election by 55,000 votes. Claims that she lost that election because 50,000 people of color were disenfranchised by cleaning up the voter rolls because they were double registered or whatever. They'd moved, whatever it was. And you go, wait a second. First of all, even if you'd got, it's a little bit presumptuous to assume that you're going to get all 50,000 votes because they happen to be black. But even if you did, you'd still lose by 5,000. That didn't stop MSNBC from going, she's really the governor-elect. She's the true governor. And raising her over $100 million. Failure is the fastest pathway to success. Martyrdom, also a quick way to success. On the left. On the left, you can fail up. You can martyr yourself up. As long as you do it for the cause, the money will follow. If you're doing it for the money, then people might go, well, wait a second, you're only doing this for the money. But if you're doing it for the cause, you can get the money. That's why charges and allegations of hypocrisy don't really register with the left. They're hypocritical all the time. If somebody on the right is hypocritical, say their family values and they have a mistress or they're anti-gay marriage, but they're gay, whatever, that's hypocritical and they're ruined. The people who follow them go, wait a second, you're doing the exact opposite. Get out of here. We don't want you. they hold him to standards. On the left, capitalism is bad. Socialism is the way to go. The rich millionaires and billionaires, Bernie, forever. And now he's a multimillionaire with three homes. Your carbon footprint is too high. You're telling me that in the winter, your vacation home on the lake in Vermont, you don't turn the heat, you don't set the thermostat at like even 50 just in case so you don't freeze the pipe? No, what's the carbon footprint of a house you're not using, Bernie? Shouldn't you just risk it or put insulation, do something? Spend the money, not the energy? And why do you stop complaining about millionaires and billionaires and only complain about billionaires the second you became a millionaire? That's hypocrisy. You're a socialist and you're rich. You're not giving your wealth away. You're not spreading your wealth around. Joe Biden, these rich people need to pay their fair share in taxes. They need to pay their fair share in taxes. Your son literally did not pay millions upon millions of dollars in taxes, and your Justice Department decided not to charge him in that, but sat around and waited long enough to decide that the statute of limitations ran out. And then they said, oh, we can't charge him. Like, yeah, that's what happens. It's weird how every prosecutor is aware of the statute of limitations, except for the people who are looking into the financial crimes of the Biden family. And then they go, oh, well, sorry about that. Yet New York State can change the statute of limitations for, say, civil liability on sexual assault for a very specific purpose, a defendant of one, Donald Trump, so that E. Jean Carroll could sue. In New York, of course. That's okay. But the federal government, the Justice Department, goes, we're contemplating the tax crimes. Millions upon millions of dollars in income that he just didn't pay any taxes on. The president saying rich people need to pay their fair share. Well, there's a rich guy who needs to pay his fair share. And not only do they not charge him because the time ran out, they can't bill him because the time ran out. Right? There's a 7-year window on taxes. Hunter Biden effectively got to not pay several million dollars in taxes. He just didn't. He doesn't have to. We know it. Everybody knows he didn't pay him, and he doesn't have to pay him. Not because the Justice Department just kind of, we got our lines crossed, and I missed that email that day, otherwise we would have gotten him. No, they made a deliberate choice. They had all the evidence. The next day the evidence came in and we're like, oh my God, I can't believe it. If we'd only had this a day earlier. They had the evidence for months, if not years. They chose to let him get away with it. You think you'd be treated the same way? Is your name Biden? No? Well, then there's your answer. Let us shift gears now that we have covered the blasé Ford thing to the southern border. Yesterday was big news. The Supreme Court said that Texas could, in fact, and for there's a legal process going through the courts saying that Texas, they want to be able to arrest illegal aliens for being illegally in the country, and they also want to be able to deport them. And Arizona tried something similar like this during the Obama administration. It's weird how it's always Democrats. Never want to enforce federal immigration law. And then when anybody does, they say, you can't do that. It's the federal government's job to enforce federal immigration law. Well, then why don't you do it? Don't tell us what to do. We can't do it. The system's broken. No, you're refusing to enforce it because the system is broken. They don't actually have an argument for it. Everybody knows we need comprehensive immigration reform. Well, why won't you deport people? There's nothing, literally. Stop. You tell us you're deporting people. And say, look, we deported 1,200 people last week. Okay, congratulations. Why not more? The system's broken. How's the system? You don't have to let them in the first place. System's broken. Comprehensive pathway to citizenship. How does that have to do with deporting? System's broken. Pathway to citizenship broken. Comprehensive. They're like a broken Teddy Ruxpin. They just keep on burping up the same thing. Comprehensive immigration system broken. Let's do it. And the media just goes, well, yeah, the system is broken. It's weird how you've only enforced part of a system and the rest of it you're pouring honey over and gas. It's weird how a car doesn't work when you're filling the gas tank with sugar. The system's broken. Boy, these cars suck. Why are you putting sugar in the gas tank? Because these cars suck. How does it suck? It doesn't run. Do you know there's sugar in the gas? You're putting sugar in the gas tank. I know, right? Sugar in the gas tank makes the car not work. This car sucks. It's your car. Japanese cars. What are you going to do? You can't argue with somebody like that. You're never going to win an argument with somebody who loses an argument to a lamppost. You're just not going. It's best not to engage in it. But they will sit there and try and force other people. It's always Democrat administrations that actively use the courts to pursue a policy of not enforcing the law. Isn't that weird? Can you think of anything during the Trump administration, anything during the Bush administration, where the Justice Department took a state to court to make sure that laws were not being enforced? That federal, we are not in federal law. Various state laws, for whatever reason, have been challenged by the federal government because they may challenge specific things. Like if we had an honest Justice Department, they would be going after the state of New York for violating the Eighth Amendment, right, against cruel and unusual punishment and excessive fines in the Trump civil case up in New York, instead of sitting there bragging about how they got him. They got him. They're going to get him. They're going to seize his property. They would do that because their job is to put all that crap aside, who it is and what the case is, and just go based on the principle and the documents at hand. But they're not about to do that. They're not going to do that any sooner than they're going to go after Hunter Biden for those taxes. But it's always Democrats who sue to stop the law from being enforced. They also sue to stop the popular will of people from being enforced when they don't like, say, referendums on gay marriage back in the day. California. Let's hold a referendum. California is super progressive. Oh, wait a second. We lost overwhelmingly. Lawsuit. This is what democracy looks like. Democracy does not look like a lawsuit. It doesn't. If you putting benefits, welfare benefits, for illegal aliens on the ballot, how well do you think that would fare? The people in New York are sick of this crap. The people in Chicago are sick of this crap. They have new community centers they're kicked out of in Chicago. For veteran centers, you can't go in there. Illegals. We're housing new migrants, new arrivals. We're paying their hotel bills. We're paying their food bills. We're giving them a stipend. How do you think a resolution, a ballot measure on that would go? State ban on, saying only welfare recipients are for citizens only. How well do you think that would go? It wouldn't go over very well. I promise you it wouldn't go over very well. This is the world that we're creating. So they sued. The Supreme Court said they stayed originally. The idea you can't enforce this while the appeal's going on, at least temporarily. We'll consider this while we consider whether or not you can do it. And then the Supreme Court said 6-3, which is unambiguous, 6-3, that you can go ahead and enforce this whilst the appeal happens. They gave them a free hand. You can go ahead and enforce this law. What? And now the Court of Appeals steps in and says, no, you can't. The Court of Appeals does not, and I'm sure there's different grounds for it, but it is a little bit weird how immediately after the Supreme Court said you can, the Court of Appeals comes in and says, no, you can't. The Court of Appeals is below the Supreme Court. It shouldn't really matter. It shouldn't really matter. The Las Americas Immigrant Advocacy Center versus Stephen McGraw, director of the Texas Department of Public Safety et al. Case. That's it. It's weird how these groups come in there. Los Americanos Immigrant Advocacy Center. Where do you think they fall on this? You think they're for heavy screening for only the non-criminal element coming across the border? No. Of course, Justice Sotomayor and Ketanji Brown Jackson, who lamented just the other day that the First Amendment unduly burdens and hinders the federal government in its quest to silence opinions it doesn't like. She's afraid that it hamstrings them. That legal genius wrote their dissent on this decision on this day. They said, today the court invites further chaos and crisis in immigration enforcement. Texas passed a law that directly regulates the entry and removal of non-citizens and explicitly instructs its state courts to disregard any ongoing federal immigration proceedings. I love it already. That law upends the federal-state balance of power that has existed for over a century. For over a century, we're 2.5 centuries old as a country. You wonder what happened in over a century. Oh, yeah, the progressive movement where they just decided to stop reading the Constitution. That's right. In which the national government has had exclusive authority over entry and removal of non-citizens. The district court here declared that Texas law amounts to nullification of federal law and authority, a notion that is antithetical to the Constitution and has been unequivocally rejected by the federal courts since the Civil War. Now, it's weird. They're saying that it's nullification of federal law and authority. Now, the and authority part is what's key. Because federal law is exactly what Texas is enforcing. That the federal government isn't enforcing, by the way. There's no consequence for the federal government not to enforce federal law. Be interesting. Let's get a Republican in the White House. Let's get a Republican Congress. And then let's just have them declare that they're not going to enforce, say, tax law. How do you think the left would sit there and go, well, no, wait a second. You have to. It's the plain language of the law. Well, it's pretty plain language. And the law is now on immigration. You're not allowed to. You enter the country illegally. You have no right to be in the country legally. Asylum claims can only be made in the first contiguous country you come to that there's no threat. You've marched through Mexico. There's no threat to you in Mexico. You should seek asylum there. All of this, it would turn their argument on their heads. But the Supreme Court said, all right, you can go ahead while you appeal this, you can go and enforce it. And Democrats went back to a lower court and got another injunction, said you can't. I believe Texas should ignore that. They are bound by what the Supreme Court said. We're going to follow what the Supreme Court said, not a lower court. A Supreme Court decree overrules a lower court decree. Sorry. So we're just going to go with that. What is the appellate court going to do? What is the enforcement mechanism that is available to the appellate court? The enforcement mechanism lies in the administration, in the executive branch. Is the Justice Department then going to try to arrest the governor, the lieutenant governor of Texas? Law enforcement, enforcing the law in Texas? Do you imagine the absolute fecal storm that would follow if the Biden administration arrested police officers enforcing immigration law? Do you imagine that? The optics of it, maybe they would if they thought that there was an advantage to them, but they did not go in and remove the barricades at Eagle Pass that had stopped. They fought tooth and nail to be able to do it, but so much attention had been shined on that they realized that to go in and physically remove the barrier that would lead again to another flood of illegals coming in at that point would be politically disastrous. So they've left it up. What would they do? How would they enforce this? Other states that are controlled by Republicans should immediately call, if they're out of session, call emergency sessions, pass a law just like Texas, but put every illegal alien in the state on notice. Hey, we come in contact with you, you're out. and then go and deport them. Mexico says, well, we will not. We will not accept anybody deported back to Mexico unless they're Mexican. Okay, fine. I don't really care. I don't care where they go. They just got to get out, right? Put them, there's an airport near Cape Horn, the southern tip of South America. Just get them on a plane and get them the hell out of here. Charter flights and private airports where you can have security run by the National Guard of each state so the leftist mob can't get out there and disrupt anything, and just start deporting people. And you do it for as long as you can. I don't know when the Supreme Court will ultimately, when this court case will be adjudicated in Texas, but as long as the Supreme Court says you can go ahead and enforce it. Unless the Supreme Court reverses itself, go out there and enforce it. Deport people. Send them back to their country of origin. If they won't tell you where that is, send them to the southern tip of South America. Get them out. It won't take that many people. A few thousand. Be nice if it was up to a few hundred thousand. But once people back in the villages who are packing up, getting ready to make themselves indentured servants to the smuggling cartels, once they begin to see people coming back and going, what the hell? They're going to unpack their bags. They're going to stop it. That is the only way to stop the flow. Telling them, don't come, is like telling your kid, don't throw a temper tantrum. We're going to go to the toy store, but do not throw a temper tantrum, all right? And then they throw a temper tantrum and you buy them what they want. All right, fine, I'll buy you what you want. That doesn't teach the lesson. It does teach a lesson. It's just not the good lesson. I took the girls to Dick's Sporting Goods the other day because I had to get new soccer cleats for Bailey. And then there's a Macy's at the mall. So I took them there, and there's a Toys R Us. Toys R Us is now owned by Macy's, the brand. And there's a section in, I don't know if it's all Macy's, but I think a lot of Macy's, where there's a Toys R Us section. On the way over there, without knowing where we were going, Quinn was telling me how for Lent, as a Catholic, you have to give up something. You know, for Lent. And she decided, now she's a little late on this, but, you know, better late than ever. She was going to give up spending my money. just till after Easter. We're not talking 40 days. We're not talking all that long, but she's going to give up spending my money, asking me to buy her things for Lent. And I was like, wow, that's great. I really appreciate it. And then she set about trying to convince Bailey to do the same thing. I don't think Bailey was down with it. I don't know if Bailey understood the concept, or maybe she did and she wasn't about to agree to it. But then probably 20 minutes later, we go walking through a Toys R Us. And I, you know, I'll take them there just to look at stuff and see what's the latest, greatest in toys and whatever. I have no problem with that. And Quinn starts carrying around a couple of things and just says, you know, it's really tough. It's really tough not to ask for the hinting around. I know that game, hinting around. And I want this, but I can't. I promised I wouldn't ask. And she was like making it clear that if I wanted to buy this stuff, it would be totally cool with her. But she's not asking. But she would very much like to have this stuff. And she may or may not be sad if she didn't get it. She didn't get it. This is the deal. She set the rules. I didn't. I probably would have bought her one thing, or bought them both one thing each, something cheap. But they set the rules, and I wasn't about to violate. Who am I to violate somebody else's thing that they gave up for Lent? That would be wrong of me. Bad parenting. But I found that was funny. But for the rest of the back to the case at hand. Follow the Supreme Court order, get every state on board, and start deporting people. In every state, you probably get 10, 15 states on board. Pass the bill today. Start enforcement today. All make it the same language as the Texas law so that there's no ambiguity. You can't say, well, it's a different thing. It sends a very explicit message to the people who are thinking about coming. Don't come. Kamala Harris saying, don't come. Don't come. That's one thing. People who went coming back and going, man, I spent $10,000 and I was a drug mule and I was forced to work for the cartels. And then they sent me home anyway. That sends a very different message. a very specific message. Somebody who's saved up $8,000 goes, well, I would just be setting this on fire if I went, or there's a chance they wouldn't let me in to begin with. Some people still take the risk. Most people won't. That's supposed to be the point of the law, a deterrent as much as punishment. That's what scares the hell out of the left more than just about anything else. All right, so we've gone through Blase Ford. We've gone through Blase Biden administration refusing to enforce the laws. By the way, while we're on Biden, I'm going to play you this clip of the president. He is, my God, I kind of want to get whatever drugs they're propping him full of when he had to give the State of the Union address. They've got to be dangerous. They clearly work. And if you give anybody 82 years old drugs, stimulants, it's going to be dangerous. So they took an awful risk. They probably said, hey, Speaker Johnson, is there any way we could do the State of the Union address, say, like, noonish? Noon, right after the breakfast special at the Sizzler, but before, and it will be done in time for the Blue Plate special for dinner. Can we do that? No? Please? So they had to pop him full of God knows what. And they had it. They had it, and it lasted probably 36 to 48 hours. But you can tell it's dangerous by the way that they don't give it to him very often. They give it to him for special occasions. I suspect the next time he's going to get anything like that, maybe there'll be a press conference. I doubt it. There'll only be a press conference if they absolutely have to. His poll numbers are his poll numbers have been in the tank forever. So there's a new poll out that Drudge and other lefties are trying to push. Like, oh, it says that his approval rating's only 47%. Disapproval's 52%. He's really rebounding. Like, you look at it, the methods are hilarious. 1,000 registered voters, which is based on the honor system, and they sent out the poll questions via text message. Like, which demographic do you think is more likely to respond to texting? Go ahead, think about it. But yeah, it's garbage. It's an outlier. It's not even an outlier. It is a fraud. But it's some polling firm I never heard of in Florida, so it was already sort of suspect. But whatever they prop him full of for the State of the Union, they can't give it to him very often, which means old Joe has to return. Slurry Joe. You know, Joe Biden is known, I mean, he's kind of known as a foreign policy expert. Never was it true. He's been known as a family man. And now that you look at his family, do you like the Manson family? Like, what family are you talking about here? So when Joe Biden is known for something, it doesn't necessarily mean it's true. In fact, it doesn't often mean it's true. But he's out there. Back to fumbling and stumbling and bumbling. And yesterday, he's talking about something that he talked about in the State of the Union address, when he accidentally said you can fly to Moscow and get cheaper drugs. He's talking about the cost of prescription drugs in other places around the world relative to the United States. Now, this is important. My mother's life was prolonged, and the quality of her life was improved dramatically by prescription drugs. And I did, I wrote a paper about this back in like 2004 or something. Like, not a paper, but a column. My first ever op-ed. I remember I was super excited because it got to run in the Detroit Free Press, which was something that they could get. And I had to call up and get the list of drugs, prescriptions that my mother had. Now, thank God they had insurance through the UAW. My dad had retired by then. He retired when I graduated high school. He actually was retired for longer than he worked. As soon as he got his 30 years, he had to, because if he'd worked, he'd have gotten a better pension, which still wasn't much. But if he'd have passed away, my mother would have only gotten his health insurance for 6 months if he was still working. But if he passed away after he retired, my mother would get his health insurance for the rest of her life, which is something she definitely and desperately needed. And I looked up the list of drugs, and I forget how I even calculated it now. It's 20 years ago. But it was somewhere in the neighborhood of $32,000 a year worth of prescription drugs that my mother was taking. Didn't have to pay anywhere near that. It was like $5 a prescription. But it was a lot. A lot. We didn't throw them away. We turned into the police. We must have looked like drug dealers who decided to go straight when my mother passed away, because there was a bunch. She always had OxyContin. She doesn't. It's all gone now. But she wouldn't take it. It was for phantom pain, and she didn't want to take it. She didn't want to take pain pills. She wanted to get through it rather than numb it. But she had it just in case, because sometimes it was so bad you had to take it. But she was afraid of becoming addicted to it. Gave that all to the cops. They were like, what the hell? Yeah, no, seriously. It's all legit. All in prescription bottles. But it was expensive. The drugs were expensive. She would not have been alive without some of them. She would have been in a poor quality of health and poor quality of life without others. Nothing was just frivolously prescribed to her. She had a lot of health problems, circulatory problems, etc. And so I understand acutely about prescription drugs. Personally, and then professionally, I was the point person at the Heritage Foundation on prescription drugs, doing a lot of research on this subject back when the Medicare Modernization Act, the prescription drug benefit, was being rammed through, and it was rammed through Congress. And if you look at the prescription drug market, there's no doubt. Look, there's a lot of drugs you don't need. You watch, I think the commercials are polluting. You go in and you say, I saw a commercial, I think I have this, can I get this pill? And doctors don't, maybe they don't want to do it, but they sit there and they kind of just go, it's easier just to give you this crap than to not give you this crap. There's a whole bunch of self-diagnosis, particularly psychologically. And then everybody's like, I saw a commercial with a sad face on a paddle, on a pickleball handle. And so I want that because I feel sad sometimes. Like, you know, it used to be, you know, called life. Not so much anymore. Now it's a disorder because everybody wants a disorder. There are problems and perversions in the pharmaceutical business. By and large, however, that is not the case. Doctors are not prescribing drugs willy-nilly, and drugs are not just being thrown out there for no good reason. There are a lot of ailments and things that people need help with. The cost, if you don't have insurance, can be a pretty penny. I get that. I had to take something last year that cost me $1,000 for 3 months' supply. $1,000. Well, I needed it. You know, it wasn't like, hey, you could try this. It might not work. I needed it. So I had to pony up. I had to pay. Sucked. Complained about it. Looked for alternatives. There really wasn't an alternative. But it helped. It worked. So, you know, knock on wood, there's that. Would I have been better off if the government says you can only charge $10 for this? Theoretically, sure. The drug already exists. So if it's $10, it's $10. I just saved $990. But if the drug didn't exist, what incentive would the government, would the drug companies have to do the research on that drug if they know at the end of the 10 to 12 year development process and all the hoops that the FDA makes them jump through for safety and some for whatever reasons bureaucrats come up with, and the $1.2 billion it costs to bring a drug to market, if they knew that they would never be able to recoup that investment, not only recoup that investment, but then make a profit over the top of it so that they could then do more research and development on other things. What do you think the odds of a drug company saying that? Well, it depends on how many people suffer from whatever it is this potential drug could treat. doesn't it? If it's a million people, you could probably make your money back, even if the government is stepping its boot on the costs that you can charge consumers or insurance companies. If it's 10,000 people, there's no way you're going to recoup that in the time window of 7 or 14 years, whatever it is, that the drug patent lasts, and then anybody can make a generic of it. If it's few people, thousands, not millions, the drug companies are going to sit there and go, well, should we bother or should we not bother? Because the rest of the world, which is the real problem, not the United States, it's, say, France, saying this pill costs $50. If we look at the cost to research and development, we look at the cost to manufacture. The cost to manufacture is next to nothing. Anybody can make a pill for really cheap. Finding the exact right components in the right amounts to put in that pill and making sure it doesn't hurt animals and it doesn't hurt people, that is expensive. Takes a lot of time. And oh, by the way, the $1.2 billion it costs to bring a new drug to market doesn't count the drugs that were in development for 7 years and then started killing rats. And they say, all right, well, we spent $700 million on that. That's just $700 million gone. It's written off. It doesn't count towards the $1.2 billion that it costs to bring a drug successfully to market. So you can see these pharmaceutical companies, as evil as you want them to be, have to make money or they won't exist. If they don't exist, who's going to develop the drugs? Who's going to manufacture them? Well, France says we don't want to pay $50. I get it. This new drug treats cancer very well, very effectively for a lot of patients, but $50 is too much. We'll pay you $10. We can't operate at $10. Well, they'll hem and haw, and it usually takes. The United States has new drugs available in this country for every ailment 6 months to a year before the rest of the world starts to get it because of this very kabuki theater process. Not only does the government negotiate the price, but then the government has to pass laws saying that they can cover it because they're all government-controlled healthcare systems. It's a mess. Bureaucratic nightmare. Eventually, the government of France, and I'm just using them as an example, will say, we will not pay $25. We told you we'll move up to $15, but that's it. And if you don't take $15, what we'll do is we'll take your patent, we'll take your concoction, we'll take your formula for your drug, and we'll give it to a French company, and they'll just make it here. Well, at that point, you realize that that's as high as they're going to go because they will steal the patent. It is sitting down negotiations with a gun on the table and a contract and saying you either sign, either your signature or your brains are going to be on this contract. That's your choice. Go ahead. Think it over. Have a cup of coffee. Go to the bathroom. Smoke a cigarette. Figure out which one you prefer. That's the kind of negotiation government does. The federal government is now starting to, our federal government is starting to move into that. All drug development in the world, 95% of drug development in the world, happens in the United States because of our free market, because of our welcoming business sense and the fact that they can make money. That is going to start slowing now when the government starts acting like the mafia. If the government, which controls Medicare, says, well, there's 45 million customers that we represent exclusively. You can't get around us. And you can either give us the price we want or you cannot have access to 45 million of your customers, by the way, who at end of life are the ones that, or even approaching the end of life, are the ones who need your product the most. Who has the leverage in that situation? Where do you go when the government screws you over? Who do you appeal to? It's nobody to appeal to. This is why you shouldn't let government control your health care. If they tell you no on a procedure that your doctor thinks will help you or could save your life, who do you appeal to? They don't care. A company can feel public pressure. A bureaucrat doesn't give a damn that a local news story about some woman about to die because the evil health insurance company turned down their procedure, and they'll cave for that. But the federal government doesn't give a damn. The pressure brought to bear on the private sector is oftentimes from the government. The government isn't going to bring pressure on itself. So when Joe Biden starts talking about we need to spend less like other countries, what somebody who is bright, who understands how markets work, and who understands the pharmaceutical industry, he should really be going to France and saying, what the hell? You can't, if you're going to threaten our intellectual property, like threaten to steal our intellectual property like that, we're going to start treating you the way we treat China, who actually steals our intellectual property, and we're going to start imposing tariffs. We're going to hurt you. You're going to have to pay more. Maybe you don't have to pay as much, but you're going to have to pay more. Because the more they pay, the less we pay. That would be a way to bring down the cost of pharmaceuticals in this country. But that doesn't make a whole lot of sense politically, because Democrats say that pharmaceutical companies are evil and making too much money, even though they're really not. And they're innovating, you know, things like saving lives. Does government save lives? No, it doesn't. But pharmaceutical companies are. Rather than go to bat for them against other countries, Democrats want to emulate other countries. Now, when that happens, because it will, because Democrats are relentless and Republicans are stupid on the issue, you'd better hope that you and the people you love get something for which there's already an effective treatment, or a lot of people get. Because rare conditions simply will not get the research. They will not get the money. That'll still happen occasionally in academia. Some of the research will happen, but it will be so slow-walked, because when it gets to the private sector, the cost-benefit analysis is going to be like, we'll never recoup what we can get here. We'll never recoup the money it'll cost us to bring this to market. It won't even come close. We'll lose $1 billion. We can't justify doing it. You ready to make that trade? Joe Biden is. With your life, not his. He's at the end of his life. He's got the money to pay for it anyway, so it doesn't really impact him. So yesterday he's out there talking and he gets confused about his own plan. And in this clip, you're going to hear him say that we could go to any foreign city in America, essentially. I can't do his level of confusion justice. A normal person not suffering from dementia, a smart person wouldn't make this mistake. A normal person not suffering from dementia would recognize this mistake. Neither happens in this clip with Sniffy Uncle Joe.
We drove out to the airport and put you on Air Force One. You said you had a prescription you needed filled, and it was an American company that made it. I'd say, okay, let's fly to Toronto or to Berlin or to London or to Rome or any major city in America. I'll get you that same prescription filled in those cities for 40% to 60% less than it costs you at a pharmacy here.
Or any major city in America. So major cities have negotiating power with prescription drug companies? No. Again, somebody not suffering from senility would recognize that. You look at somebody right in their face, and you know their name is Todd, and you go, hey, Bob. You don't just go, bah, whatever, he knows I'm talking to him. You go, Todd. And you correct yourself. You catch it. If you've just met that person, you're like, sorry, I know your name is Todd, not Bob. A normal human being catches those sorts of things. Somebody suffering from dementia is unaware that they've made a mistake. They're unaware of where they are or what they're doing. Joe Biden was reading that off a teleprompter. Reading that off a teleprompter means that he is so focused on the next word in the teleprompter that he is blissfully unaware of the previous word on the teleprompter. So that when he reads something wrong, far be it for me to criticize anybody for that. I read things wrong all the time. But when you read something wrong, it registers. It's not registering with Joe. It's written there for him, and it's not registering with Joe. That's why when he was all hopped up on the speed or whatever they had him on at the State of the Union address, he could hold up a button that said, say her name, Laken Riley. It said it. He picked it up. He looked at it. He showed it to the audience as he said Lincoln Riley twice. And it didn't register. It didn't register. because he knows that he has to focus so much on what comes next that he really can't pay attention to what's happening now. You only do that when you don't know what you're talking about or you're suffering from dementia. Now, there's a possibility, I guess, that Joe doesn't know what he's talking about. There's always that possibility. Like I say, he's been dumb a lot longer than he's been suffering from senility. But this happens too often to be anything other than dementia. And even if he weren't suffering from dementia, my God, the ramifications of what he's advocating for are horrible. But much like everything else, he advocates for where the ramifications are horrible and destructive. Quite frankly, because of his age, he's not really going to be around for. It's really easy. Politicians play kick the can with responsibility. Social Security's going to go bankrupt. Medicare's going to go bankrupt. The federal government's going to go bankrupt. They're all just hoping it doesn't happen on their watch. They don't really look, they're rich. They will be in, their ancestors will be insulated. Their children, their grandchildren will be insulated by and large from the horrible consequences of their stupid decisions. They won't care about the blame. They won't personally be around to feel it. And the Democratic Party and the left-wing establishment will circle the wagons around them anyway, the way they did around FDR, whose policies prolonged and deepened the Great Depression rather than solve it. They all just sit around and go, yeah, no, the New Deal totally got us out of the Great Depression. Really? Then why did the New Deal start passing in 1933, but we didn't start to recover from the Depression until 1940? When we started ramping up for war. Anybody want to answer that? No, nobody wants to answer that question. Because to answer that question is an inconvenient truth. And to the left, the truth does not help them at all. So they tell something else. Before we run out of time, I've got a couple of clips I want to play for you, though. First is the governor of Virginia, Glenn Youngkin. Loudoun County School District, their school board there is one of the big reasons that this, what the horrors that are going on in public schools is known. They were famous for covering up sexual assault in their bathroom by a transgender student, overdose. They've just tried to hide everything from parents. Parents don't have a need to know, right to know, nothing. Nobody knows parents. Nobody knows kids more than teachers. Nobody cares more than kids. There's the state. It's very Soviet out there. Unfortunately, these morons, the people have been replaced, but by similar morons, right? The old school board said, I've imposed my will on this. People don't like me. They're harassing me. They hate me. They blah, blah, blah. I'm not going to run again. And then other people go, well, I'll be dumb enough to stand up and do the same things. And they get elected. So it's hard to feel sorry for them. But just to show you how far the left will go, they don't like being criticized. It's weird, the free speech people. They have now decided that in the interest of transparency, they're going to shut off the cameras at school board meetings. How you square that circle, I don't know, but that's what they're doing, is shutting off the cameras at school board meetings because they don't want people to, what people are saying to them, to get out. Governor Youngkin calls them out on this rather effectively.
This is stunning. To be clear, this is the same school board in Loudoun County that tried to hide girls being sexually assaulted in bathrooms, didn't want to tell parents when there were overdoses at their schools, and now has the completely misguided view that turning off cameras increases transparency. I mean, do they remember who they work for? They work for parents. And the Loudoun County School Board needs to absolutely get it together.
This is together for the left, Governor. This isn't by accident. You give them too little credit for being diabolical and evil when you kind of sit there. Do they not realize what they're doing? Of course they realize what they're doing. They don't care. The consequences they face entail nothing. Nothing. they get reelected. So, well, don't the politicians in Chicago realize that people are being murdered and alarming? Yeah, they do. They don't care. Don't the administration and city council in Philadelphia recognize that huge swaths of what used to be a viable commercial district are now overrun with junkies sleeping in tents? Yes, they do. They don't care. Because why? Because the consequences were nothing. There's no consequence. Who cares? Speaking of consequences, I just want to play you this really quickly of General Milley yesterday testifying about the disastrous Afghanistan withdrawal. He casually mentions and doesn't seem to care, doesn't seem to be bothered, and none of the Democrats were bothered by the fact that the Afghans who worked with the United States and some Americans were left behind and were hunted down and murdered. He just kind of said, yeah, some of them were probably murdered, some of them hiding, some of them got out some other way. They were abandoned by the Biden administration, who was just grabbing anybody, terrorists included, and slapping them on planes to try and say, we evacuated 120,000 people. Did you vet any of them? No, we didn't. We didn't have time for that. We got them, and now they're free, and they're on welfare here. So we're heroes, right? Meanwhile, the people who actually did help us are being hunted down and murdered.
Are they in jail, dead, some of them?
I think some were killed. Afghans. I don't know about the Americans. I don't think the Americans were. But I think some of the Afghans were tracked down that worked with us. And I think some of them were killed and I'm pretty certain some of them in pretty brutal ways. Some were managed to escape through various means. Others have just laid low and keeping their heads down.
Don't you love it? This should be a major story. Yeah, well, the people that we promised, don't work with us. We'll take care of you. We surely would not abandon you. Work with us. Then we just abandoned them. It was a complete disorder. It was a mess. We gave up Bagram Air Base for no reason whatsoever. People got killed. People were murdered. 13 American servicemen and women murdered by a terrorist attack. In retaliation, what did the Biden administration do? Remember when they bombed that minivan? This is the person responsible, and it turns out it wasn't. They blew up a minivan with a father and 7 kids in it. Remember that? It's been memory hold. Nobody's been held accountable for that at all. Nobody was fired over the disastrous withdrawal from Afghanistan. Nobody faced any consequences for it. Joe Biden doesn't even have it mentioned anymore. But there's General Milley. Doesn't seem to care either. Oh, some of them were killed. Some of them are in hiding. Some of them managed to get out by other means. Some are probably just trying to keep their heads down, hoping that they're not blown to smithereens. But don't worry about that. Joe Biden is still president. If one thing you can say is there were no mean tweets about it, so he's got that going for him. These people, what scum. All right, that is enough for today. Let us get on with a Thursday, and then we can get to Friday. Thank freaking God. Holy Frank Tanana, I'm ready for that. Thank you for listening, spreading, sharing the word, all that good stuff. Sorry I was a little in the weeds today, if I was, but, you know, sometimes it's called for. I'll see you tomorrow.